close eye on Iran. He also claimed that Defense Secretary James Mattis resigned because he told him to do it. This is USA Radio News.
With a recession ending, if you've been putting off building your business, now is the time to act. General Steel will meet or beat any price on a pre-engineered steel building of the same size and specifications. Act now before steel prices go up. So call us today for free information.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290.
The New England Patriots are champions of the National Football League once again.
Yes! It's still a dynasty!
The call on the Patriot Radio Network as they beat the Los Angeles Rams 13-3. For most of the game, it was a defensive struggle. The score was tied 3-3, then midway through the fourth quarter, Patriot quarterback Tom Brady took over and led the Patriots on a 67-yard drive. That ended by a 2-yard touchdown run by Sony Michel that proved to be the game-winning score. The Patriots added a field goal at the very end. New England wins their 6th Super Bowl championship. Ram fans were disappointed, but Patriot fans were ecstatic.
Oh, 6, baby! 6, that's all I got to say.
Go Pats! Heck yeah! Brady number 6!
President Trump may face challenges within his own party in 2020. USA's Rick Vincent reports.
Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld plans to headline Politics and Eggs in New Hampshire in 2 weeks, a must stop for White House hopefuls. And Maryland Governor Larry Hogan expressed interest this week to CNN.
I'm not protesting every day about every issue, but when I stand up and certainly let people know when I disagree or when I think something is going on that I don't think is right.
And an email this week by former Ohio Governor John Kasich's political group reminded supporters that many have suggested Governor Kasich should run, and he is keeping all of his options on the table. For USA Radio News, I'm Rick Vincent.
For USA Radio News, I'm Wendy King.
This is Georgine Trinkle. I want to invite you to listen to Huntin' Huntin' In every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. You'll be treated to discussions on hot topics every week. Huntin' Huntin' In provides a more in-depth look at issues that are happening right now. You can catch the show live and call in on what matters to you. Make sure to download the podcast to catch up on all our hot topics.
Well, good afternoon, folks. You've heard about fire safety, I think, in the program just before me, which is great, and I think everybody really needs to pay attention, especially, with the carbon monoxide detectors. I think that's something that most of us grew up didn't even think about, carbon monoxide, but, there have been some unfortunate deaths as a result of people not thinking about it. So in any event, I'm Pat Smith, and I'm here, first of all, I'm your weather person, and let's see, can it be any better out? I mean, after this last week and all of the cold, I guess cold, of course, in New Jersey is, zero or below, one below zero. But in any event, today was sunny, beautiful, fair. About 52 degrees tonight, mostly clear, and this is going to be, although colder, it's going to be a really nice weekend. Tomorrow, sunny, only a high of about 33 degrees, so we're not going to have what we had today, but tomorrow night should be clear and mostly sunny on Sunday, a high of about 37 degrees. And there is a chance of snow on Sunday night because the low could be around 25 degrees. So there's about a 40% chance of snow. Doesn't look like it's going to be really much in the way of an accumulation if it does snow. Possibly You know, it's just really little or no accumulation is expected. By Monday, should be mostly cloudy. And then again, Monday night, there is a chance, about a 50% chance of some precipitation. Going into Tuesday, if they're right, there could be snow and sleet before in the morning before 1 p.m. Then the problem is if it's freezing rain and sleet in the afternoon and then rain later, that's going to be that kind of mess that we really don't need and we see so often here in New Jersey. So that's the weather. I can't seem to find any spots for our sponsors, so I'm just going to do something, and then I'll be right back.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Okay, we're back again, and I'd like to make an announcement. I don't know where all of our sponsor announcements are, so I'm just going to have to wing that. But what I would like to let everybody know, especially members out there, number one, we're going to have a breakfast. I want to call it a hangover breakfast, and I'm going to play a spot so I can try to get our correct spots, and I'll be back in just a couple minutes.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
NAMI, either in English or Spanish, great organization here in Hunterdon. In fact, there are so many good volunteer organizations in Hunterdon. Of course, probably the best for everyone is the Chamber. And as I started to say, I was looking around, somebody took my list that I'm supposed to tell you who our sponsors are today, so excuse me. But I started to say that for the members out there, we hope you will invite a prospective member. We're going to have a breakfast on Monday, March 18th, from 8:30 until 9:45 at Zoop Eatery, and that is on 100 Rayville Avenue in the shopping center. And if you're someone who's not a member of the Chamber, please call the Chamber. Call me. I'm Pat Smits, and I would love to have you as a guest. There are just a lot of opportunities when you join the Chamber. And so this is for what we call the Future Members Breakfast Reception. And for any member, your ticket is to bring a prospective member. And, of course, this is without cost. chamber. It's cost to the chamber, but not to the prospective members. And I think you'll find a wide variety of people in the chamber. I've been a member now for, well, it's a few years. And I had never even thought about joining the chamber, but happened to run into somebody who was a member and came to a couple activities and then decided it was more than worthwhile, and it has been. So now you have to put up with me on Friday afternoons. I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County. I practice all over the state, but the program, it's the law, and I try to bring you information about what's going on in legal news. So not obviously sometimes the most thrilling. And, of course, I have to mention that they had to talk about the Super Bowl, which I suppose we'll talk about on the next program. It's the Sports Guys program. But for many of us, we're just over football, but not over all of the other things that are going on sports-wise. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. But what is happening right now? There have been some criminal cases that published criminal cases. And one of the things, one of the appellate court here in New Jersey has affirmed an agency decision prohibiting New Jersey residents from placing bets on horse races in the state while physically out of state. So in other words, you go down to Florida. Well, I guess most people don't go down to Florida during the racing season in New Jersey. But the point is, even if you're a New Jersey resident, if you're out of state, you cannot place bets in the state while physically out of the state. Not sure why that came about, but that did. So there's an effort to use the Amazon's arbitration provision to dispense with class claims against makers of a digital home video system which sold the product on Amazon but wasn't a party to the contract, and that failed. So that there's going to be a lot of questions about what's happening with these arbitration clauses. Obviously, if you signed an arbitration clause and there's an issue, my suggestion is see an attorney who can really interpret whether or not the arbitration provision is probably going to be enforced or won't be enforced. Big difference. And frankly, although I could read it, even I would talk to someone else, because that's not the type of law that I handle. And I was talking recently with a group of attorneys, and in New Jersey, you do not need an attorney if you're buying or selling a home. In North Jersey, we're part of North Jersey, most people have attorneys. In South Jersey, most people, or many people, if not most, don't have attorneys. They allow the title companies to handle it. As an attorney, I would tell you I would never buy or sell a house without retaining an attorney. And I would, of course, retain a real estate attorney, because these contracts are very complicated. Dealing with everything that goes on these days in real estate, it's very foolish not to have an attorney involved. But in any event, that's not just a spot for attorneys. It's really common sense. I mean, the amount of money most people are selling or buying houses, it's the biggest purchase of most of our lives, so we should make sure that there's not going to be any problem. And, of course, title insurance is vital to make sure that there are no problems that, could be a situation with the property that you don't know. And I would give a plug for someone in the title business, but won't. Just make sure that, in my view at least, make sure that you're not just using the title company owned by the realtor. And I guess other people would say, why not? I just feel that, better to have somebody independent. But in any event, let's see what else is happening in the law. As I said, there's taxation legislation that people are complaining about, not just federal, but certainly state. Their tort claims mounting, and the city of Trenton, if you recall, there was a shooting at an arts festival in Trenton. Actually, there was a mass shooting incident that broke out. That was in June of last year, and the city of Trenton has filed suit seeking indemnification from the organizers of the arts festival. And, you know, really unfortunate because, you know, this could happen anywhere, but I'm sure that it will really be a damper to anyone thinking of putting on such, you know, events in Trenton. And that's really unfortunate. And I'm not sure that they could even get insurance, but that's another situation. There was a criminal case just reported today, Friday, Wednesday. And this was a law division case, and a defendant moved to reopen his detention hearing. And he had been arrested and charged with aggravated sexual assault and endangering the welfare of a child. And what happened is the state moved to detain defendant pending trial, and that was pursuant to the Criminal Justice Reform Act. And, of course, I've talked about the Criminal Justice Reform Act, and, you know, probably the majority of people now are released on their own recognizance. But this was, of course, a very serious crime, aggravated sexual assault. And at the detention hearing, the state's proffer, meaning what they expected to prove, outlined the circumstances surrounding the defendant's arrest, including the nature of defendant's relationship with the victims. So there was more than one, and how the defendant used that relationship to commit sexual assaults. Now, this is State versus WA, which we always use initials, and the state, of course, tries to protect the victims. In this case, apparently, there were two, at least as part of this case, because the state noted that both victims individually corroborated the assaults and the defendant's behavior and appearance. So it wasn't just one here. They had two victims. And I know, should be alleged victims, but in any event, two victims. So the trial court in this case granted pretrial detention, concluding that the defendant represented a danger to the victims and others based on the state's proffer to find probable cause to believe the defendant had committed the charged offenses. The defendant failed to timely appeal the pretrial detention order. Instead, he later moved to reopen the detention hearing, alleging that certain evidence related to the state's proffer, meaning what they expected to prove, was not provided during the original during the original pretrial detention hearing. And he said that that exonerated rather than implicated him. And the defendant also argued that having such evidence during the original hearing would have allowed him to undermine the state's probable cause proffer and to argue for pretrial release. So in this case, the court denied the defendant's motion to reopen the pretrial detention hearing, and the court ruled, for example, that the state was not required to disclose the photograph of defendant's genitalia, which the state relied on in its proffer that the victim's description matched the photograph. The court noted that the photograph was not used to identify the defendant, but instead was used to corroborate the victim's statements. And moreover, the trial court noted that the state provided a sufficient description of the photograph's contents. And the court also noted the defendant could have obtained his own photograph to contest the state's proffer. You know, remember what we're talking about for photographs of his genitalia. So ultimately, the court concluded that there was no new information to warrant reopening the pretrial detention hearing, as all the information cited by the defendant was available to him. So that was very important. This was not information that was not available to him during the original hearing. And this case was approved for publication, and this means that other trial judges, or it can be cited to other trial judges. It does not mean that other trial judges would have to follow anything that's cited in this case, because this is a law division judge, and other judges on the same level do not have to follow. So to the extent that it was published, great. It can be used by other prosecutors and defense attorneys. But the fact is that it's not an appellate case, so it does not have to be followed, if there's anything to follow, by other trial judges. And frankly, this is very specific, but it gives good guidance. So there was another case. This is the appellate division, where the defendant appealed the denial of his PCR petition, alleging ineffective assistance of trial and direct appeal counsel. So in other words, he said his attorneys didn't do a good job. And he was charged with first-degree murder and related offenses. And he was tried alongside his co-defendant. And he was ultimately convicted of the lesser-included offense of first-degree aggravated assault. And he was sentenced to a 30-year prison term. He filed a direct appeal arguing the trial court erred in not granting severance and also admitting prior bad act evidence and failing to instruct the jury on voluntary intoxication and self-defense, among other issues. However, the court rejected those arguments and affirmed the defendant's conviction and sentence. The defendant then filed a timely PCR petition asserting ineffective assistance of counsel, which was also denied. And then on appeal, the court reversed the denial of defendant's PCR petition and remanded for a new trial. So this was pretty significant. So the appellate division ruled the defendant was deprived of effective counsel due to trial counsel's failure to request a jury charge on self-defense. Obviously, very, very important, if in fact that was one of the questions in the case. The court noted, meaning the appellate court noted, the defense counsel's summation pointed to evidence supporting a claim of self-defense, specifically that the victim posed a threat to the defendant. The court rejected the state's assertion that defendant's claim was barred because his self-defense claim had already been decided on the direct appeal. That's interesting. So, first appeal denied, then he filed an appeal on ineffective assistance of counsel, and on that appeal, the court held that its ruling on defendant's self-defense claim on the direct appeal was less than conclusive. But the appellate court ruled that the error in concluding in the defendant's direct appeal that omission of a jury instruction on self-defense did not have the capacity to produce an unjust result. However, the court noted that had the jury been instructed on self-defense, defendant may have also obtained an acquittal on a lesser included offense of aggravated manslaughter. So, this was in fact important, and it went back to the trial court. There was yet another a case, criminal law, State versus ER, and in that the state moved to admit statements the victim's mother made to a physician. This is another law division case. So in this case, at trial, the state moved to admitted, you know, victim's mother made certain statements to the physician. And the defendant in that case was charged with aggravated sexual assault and endangering the welfare of a child. These are tough, tough cases, by the way. The state alleged that the mother picked up her daughter, the alleged victim, pursuant to a custody agreement with the victim's father, who is the defendant. The mother had not seen the victim for approximately 3 months, and the mother took the victim to the hospital where she tested positive for gonorrhea. Now, physicians concluded that the victim had contracted gonorrhea within a week or two of her hospital visit. And the defendant was the only male residing at his home who also tested positive for gonorrhea. So during the questioning, the defendant admitted to sexual contact with the victim. So the state also sought to admit the physician's statements under a hearsay exception for statements made for medical diagnosis and treatment. Okay, that was what that was for. And the court granted the state's motion. The court noted that the exception did not cover statements made to physicians in contemplation of litigation, nor did it cover statements naming alleged perpetrators of crime, since such statements were typically irrelevant to the medical diagnosis and treatment. Therefore, the court ruled that the victim's mother's statement or statements to her physicians were admissible as they were made to help doctors diagnose and formulate treatment for the victim rather than for litigation purposes. But the court ruled that any statements purportedly to identify a perpetrator of the victim's sexual assault would have to be redacted as they were not admissible under the exception to the hearsay rule. So this, there are a number of exceptions to the hearsay rule. What is the hearsay rule? Basically, it's any out-of-court statements, unless they fall under the numerous exceptions, cannot be used at trial. So you third-party conversations, hearsay is statements made, outside of the trial. In matrimonial statements between the parties, that's different. But, for example, if the wife tells her mother something or husband tells one of his friends something, their conversation is hearsay. Okay, let me play a couple spots that now that I have my sheet, and then we'll come back and talk about some of the other issues that have come up this week.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into
Never mind you!
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive.
Okay, we're back, and I mentioned earlier that there was a question and about whether or not a New Jersey resident can place a bet when they're out of state. This was the appellate division case. And the case is Stein versus Department of Law and Public Safety. And this was a situation where the petitioner appealed from a denial of his petition for adoption of administrative rule allowing New Jersey residents to place wagers with New Jersey's account wagering system while physically outside of the state. Now, the petitioner argued that the Off-Track and Account Wagering Act did not prohibit such wagering. And in fact, what they call the OTAWA, the Off-Track and Account Wagering Act, authorized licenses permitting off-track wagering and to issue a license to establish an AWS, you know, some kind of a wagering office, obviously, account wagering something. And that also allowed New Jersey residents 18 or older to establish accounts with an AWS and to place wagers with an AWS without being physically present at a New Jersey racetrack or off-track wagering facility. Now, petitioner, a New Jersey resident, was unable to place a wager on his account while on vacation in Massachusetts. Petitioner requested that the state stop enforcing the out-of-state restriction on account wagering for New Jersey residents. Been interesting to find out, and I haven't read the entire case to find out how he was trying to do that. Was it with a cell phone with a New Jersey number? And, you know, what if you have a cell phone with an out-of-state number even though you're in New Jersey? So I guess if anyone's interested, they have to track down exactly how they find out if you're out of state. In any event, the commission denied the request, concluding that the legislative intent of the Off-Track and Account Wagering Act was to create an intrastate wagering system, meaning just in New Jersey. On appeal, the petitioner argued that the state had authority under the off-track betting to adopt a rule allowing AWS account holders to place wagers with an AWS while the account holder is temporarily outside of New Jersey. However, the appellate division affirmed the denial of the petition. They rejected the argument that because the act did not expressly prohibit account holders from placing wagers from locations outside of New Jersey, that was kind of a so what. Instead, the court agreed with the state that the legislature's repeal of the phrase within the state demonstrated the intent to limit placement of wagers to account holders who were presently physically located in New Jersey. And the court further rejected the argument that not permitting New Jersey residents to place wagers while they were outside of New Jersey violated the Commerce Clause. So this is why it was constitutional. So the reason for that is the appellate division noticed that the off-track and account wagering act did not regulate wager systems operated by other states. So therefore, they concluded that that its burden on interstate commerce was incidental. So could have been a different scenario depending on how it doesn't affect interstate commerce, in other words. Now, there was a juvenile case. If you're interested in any juvenile cases in the interest of CF, now this, of course, this was an appellate division, and the state appealed from the family parts orders diverting three separate complaints charging defendants with certain offenses. And each defendant was a juvenile charged with conduct that, if committed by an adult, would have constituted a disorderly person's offense. However, the family part judge notified the state of her intention to divert the complaints of all three defendants. However, she did not provide notice to the defendants. At a hearing, the state objected to the family court's determination that the defendants were not required to be present at the hearing. So, relying on the court's opinion in State in the Interest of NP, the family judge ruled that the law only required the state, not the defendants, the opportunity to be heard, because requiring defendants to appear in court would defeat the purpose of diversion by exposing them to the formal calendar. So, interesting, because these are juveniles. Because the juvenile defendants, were not present at the hearing, the state did not provide the police reports relating to the defendants' arrests, nor did the family court judge have information about the defendants' personal circumstances. However, over the state's objection, the judge diverted defendants' complaints, and on appeal, the court reversed. The appellate division reversed and remanded the family part's decision. The court noted that as a matter of due process, juvenile offenders were entitled to all rights constitutionally guaranteed to criminal indictment. Now, that except for the right to indictment, trial by jury, and bail. The court held that the juveniles were entitled to counsel during every stage of the delinquency proceedings. The court therefore ruled that the family part if the family part chooses to hold a diversionary hearing, the judge is statutorily required to provide notice to all parties and to all interested persons. So the appellate court held that the family court judge erred by holding the diversionary hearing without providing notice or opportunity to appear to the defendants. So that was another case approved for publication to give guidance to trial judges. That's exactly what that does. It says that, you know, the defendants, you know, have a right to be there and have to be noticed. Now, a seizure of a firearm from a partygoer after the police had completed an investigation of a noise complaint, according to our Supreme Court, was in fact unconstitutional. So what happened in that case, State versus Chisholm, decided this week, the defendants appealed from the appellate division's order affirming the denial of their motion to suppress. So there was a motion to suppress this. And the police responded to a noise complaint in a motel room. Although the renter of the room complied with the request to turn down the music, and the officers decided not to issue a summons, the police subsequently ran warrant checks on the group of 10 people in the room, not permitting any individual to leave until their warrant check came back clean. So what happened then is the police arrested defendant Chisholm for an outstanding warrant and found a concealed firearm on his person. So the officers then conducted pat-down of the rest of the group and they found another firearm on Defendant Woodward. The trial court denied the defendant's motion to suppress the handguns found on their persons. And so as a result, they pled guilty to weapons charges. You know, they guess they had him dead to rights. However, on appeal, the court reversed the denial of defendant's motion to suppress. The appellate court ruled that once the renter of the motel room agreed to lower the music volume and the officers decided not to issue a summons, then the police no longer had reasonable suspicion to continue detention of the occupants in the room or to run warrant checks. Thus, the court ruled that because officers had no reasonable suspicion to continue the detention, both the warrant check and the subsequent pat-down of Chisholm and the pat-down of Woodward were unlawful, and as were the handguns seized from them. And as a result, they were all subject to the exclusionary rule, meaning that the evidence would be excluded at trial. Okay. There was a family law case, which is interesting. It had to do with a military pension plan, and it's a little convoluted. This was our own Judge Mala in the appellate division, and in this case, the defendant appealed from an order requiring him to indemnify the plaintiff for the loss of her share of the equitable distribution of his military pension, which was waived following defendant's receipt of disability benefits. So then there was a cross appeal by the plaintiff arguing the trial court should have granted her request for alimony to replace the lost pension. So the trial court equitably distributed the parties. Equitably distributed the parties' pensions. And after that, the defendant continued serving in the military until he became disabled, at which time he opted for disability benefits. So plaintiff wife later learned that because defendant was receiving a portion of his benefit on disability, it was statutorily prohibited from being divided. In other words, couldn't divide it. Plaintiff then moved to compel defendant to compensate her for her share of the pension. So again, the trial court ultimately in this case ordered defendant to pay plaintiff a monthly lump sum payment, and the court characterized it. So this was a lump sum payment that he had to pay monthly, and the court characterized it as equitable distribution payment rather than alimony payment because the parties had waived alimony. So on appeal, the defendant argued that the trial court's order requiring indemnification was expressly preempted by the U.S. Supreme Court. And there are these cases where, there, especially in family law, there are some issues that would be preempted by the federal court. So, there's some malpractice cases over the creation of dynasty trusts. If you have enough money to even consider doing something like that, you absolutely have to get to an attorney and an experienced attorney. There was a $115,000 settlement of an overtime dispute, and this was a collection law firm. So many of you have seen this, would probably be jumping in joy. But in any event, the collection firm Pressler, Felt, and Warshaw has agreed to a $115,000 settlement to resolve claims that it violated the wage and hour laws by failing to pay overtime to an information technology employee. So some of these things we have to look into when, in fact, it's you're in the hot seat. And there are a lot of, you know, arcane decisions. But you have to be sure that you get the most recent and the highest court's decision. Well, there. Well, let me play a couple spots, and I'm trying to figure out which would be the more interesting. Not that any of them are, but the more interesting case for the listeners.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Back again while we were off air, it reminded me talking to trying to remember who the other day had to do with some real estate issues, and again, people need to make sure that they have good advice when they're dealing with real estate. There was a contract, real estate contract, that might be of interest, and I can't pronounce the man's name. It's Khusid, K-H-U-S-I-D, versus Wilkin, and this was a appellate division case where the plaintiff appealed from an order of disposition entered in favor of the defendant, and the motion was to dismiss the plaintiff's breach of contract claim, requesting monetary damages to repair parking spaces at his residence. So what happened is plaintiff owned a single-family attached duplex in the Long Meadow neighborhood, and Long Meadow was governed by a neighborhood association, which contracted with the defendant for property management services. So the defendant was doing the services for the complex, including the defendant. So what happened? Well, the case in this case, the manager asserted that the neighborhood's declaration that did not include driveways. Okay. So the question here is, the manager asserted that the neighborhood's declaration did not include driveways or parking bays, as common elements. So the plaintiff ultimately filed the present action, alleging the defendant's company failed to comply with its contract for Mason expenses. Plaintiff argued that the neighborhood, the declaration should also include, well, should include the, so the manager asserted that the declaration did not include driveways or parking bays as common elements. Now, the defendant's company failed to comply with its contract for residential, excuse me, for making repairs, and the plaintiff argued that the neighborhood's declaration was limited. So that, however, the finding that it was undisputed evidence that the parking spaces were on plaintiff's property, on appeal, the court affirmed dismissal of the plaintiff's action, and the court noted that there was no contract between the plaintiff and the property. Well, that's, I didn't think there was much in the way of interesting cases this week, and I guess I'm right. So what else is happening? Well, there were a number of cases this last year that were interest if you're interested in family law, since maybe I will talk about a few of those because it, that's my area. And some of these cases really are interesting and certainly shows why people need to go and consult with attorneys, at least have an initial consultation. I'm doing that this weekend. I'm going to have an initial consultation. It's actually not an initial consultation. It's really it's going to be a follow-up and a second opinion. And I have no problem with any of my clients doing that, and I don't think anyone should, because sometimes a second opinion can reveal things that are really helpful, and I'm certainly hoping that will be the case. And, I'm certainly most likely going to agree with the current attorney on how things are going. However, there are a couple issues that, there are a couple proposals out there, and I think I can certainly tell that some of these are more problematic from a tax standpoint, and at least the client needs to know that. Having problems finding my sheet again. Okay, let me play one quick spot. And then
hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com. And I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hunterdon Chamber Radio entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
All right, let me just mention, and I've been doing this somewhat, but some of the cases that are of interest, I think that one that should be of interest to not only family people in family law, but other people, because it is an opinion by the appellate division called Curran versus Curran, C-U-R-R-A-N, and it was decided by the appellate division in 2018, and the issue in that case, whether or not the court can properly sever an unenforceable clause in the party's arbitration agreement while still enforcing the remainder of that agreement? And in that particular case, the answer was yes, as long as the unenforceable clause does not affect the primary purpose of the agreement. The court can, in fact, sever the clause while still enforcing the remainder of the arbitration agreement and award. In this case, the parties entered into an arbitration agreement to resolve issues relating to their divorce. And the agreement specifically stated, quote, "The parties reserve their rights to appeal the arbitrator's award to the appellate division as if the matter was determined by the trial court." Now, this is interesting because if a case is tried to conclusion, either party has a right to file an appeal. With arbitration, that is problematic because, the right to appeal an award, what the trial court determined in this case, is that there was no basis to vacate the award under any of the grounds listed in the what we call the arbitration statute, NJSA 2A23B-23. Additionally, in this case, the trial court ruled that the right to appeal the award in the appellate division was unenforceable because the parties, you can't create subject matter jurisdiction in the appellate division. In other words, just because you want to go to the appellate division doesn't mean that you have the right to do it. Maybe even a better example would be an agreement that would state that either party has a right to take the case up to the Supreme Court. Well, we know you have the right to ask the Supreme Court to take a case, and it's only a right if, in fact, there's a dissent in the appellate division, which doesn't happen often. So in any event, in this current case, the trial judge confirmed the arbitration award and the appeal followed. So the sentence that was in question said the only recourse available to the parties is review by the trial court provided under the statute. However, the appellate division found that striking the unenforceable provision did not render the rest of the arbitration agreement unenforceable because it did not defeat the contract or the central purpose of the contract. So the primary purpose of the arbitration agreement was to resolve the parties' issues related to their divorce. And they agreed that it would go to arbitration, and they agreed there were different things that you put in an arbitration agreement. But basically, you're hiring a private judge. So again, the appellate division found that even without this provision, the parties could still accomplish the primary purpose of the agreement. So even if that one provision had to be stricken, the remainder of the agreement was valid and enforceable. In fact, the appellate division found that if it wasn't enforced, it would defeat the central purpose of the agreement, frustrating the party's intent. In other words, you can't come back and find later on, if you didn't like it, that you're going to get some relief. And even if there's a provision in the agreement, that's not enforceable. And most of us in property settlement agreements or marital settlement agreements, we'll put in a clause that if provisions in the agreement are modified by a court or deleted by a court, all other provisions will continue in full force and effect unless they materially affect the agreement. So that, if it was a huge and material reason that you can't take one thing out without the other because the whole thing requires both of these clauses, that's a different situation. Hope that made some sense. Of course, the big thing this year is how in the world are we going to figure out alimony and child support, or even child support, now with this new tax law. Lots of discussions, but nobody knows the answer. I mean, what it does mean is that the two parties, the family, is going to have less money because you don't shift the tax.